Hi, this is Brian, and we are reading The Hill for Tuesday, August 18. The story, Trump's aircraft carrier demands, may lead to a waiting game for Navy. President Trump is increasingly putting his thumb on the scale by wading more into the designs of U.S. aircraft carriers, backing potentially seismic design changes that would increase construction costs and scramble timelines to complete the build. The president has ordered a return to steam catapults on Ford-class aircraft carriers, and the U.S. Navy is conducting a review to consider possibly moving the multi-mortiary aircraft carrier's command center tower toward the middle of the vessel. Industry experts believe Trump's aesthetic concerns will not be implemented in the long run as the current aircraft carrier's build is underway. They suggested that Navy officials either will convince Trump that the newer electromagnetic aircraft launch systems, or EMALS, and advanced weapons elevators, or AW, on the warships are the way to go, or will wait him out. I think the idea with this and with the electromagnetic catapult is to do the studies and maybe do some of the redesign work, but not actually incorporate it into the ships, because the actual construction part of those ships is far enough in the future that they could wait it out, right, and wait until the president's out of office, and then just not implement the change. Brian Clark, a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, said in a Monday interview. Brent Sadler, a Navy veteran of 26 years, with several operational tours on submarines, said the engineers and pilots will eventually make the case to Trump to keep the current placement of the island and stick to EMALS, AWS, and Advanced Arresting Gear, or AAG. But he said that might not end things with Trump, whose mind might be made up on what he wants. It's all part of the same review. So the president has a view. He wants things to be more grand, said Sadler, who is now a senior research fellow for Naval Warfare and Advanced Technology for the Allison Center for National Security and the Heritage Foundation. He wants things to be more reliable, and I think when he gets the math back, the engineers give him back the study in 60 days, I think you'll see things moderate, but I don't think he's going to let up, he said. He has a long memory, and he loves the Navy, has a lot of interest in the Navy, and that's good. Doesn't always feel that way if you're on the receiving end, but I mean, he's very much paying attention, Sadler said. I think that's a good thing. The Navy is conducting an internal review, looking at whether to move the island more toward the middle of the Ford-class aircraft carriers to better fit the aesthetic of older warships desired by Trump, The Hill reported Sunday. The island, which sticks above the rest of the aircraft carrier's deck and is positioned on the starboard side, is the nerve center for overlooking the vessel's navigation, tactical command, and flight deck operations. Navy Admiral Gary Roughead, the former chief of naval operations from 2007 to 2011, said the Navy's internal study is not going to drop off the president's priority list. He said the real questions are how thorough the service branch's review is, what factors the Navy will incorporate into it, and how it will weigh the various operational impacts of making the change. I think they also will have to look at what are the engineering changes that are required, the amount of effort and man hours that will go into making that design change, if in fact the decision is made to change the design, and the effort and the engineering effort and design effort obviously will detract from other shipbuilding design initiatives that are in play and engineering issues that are in play, Roughead said in an interview with The Hill on Monday. The retired Navy Admiral said the Navy will have to consider other disruptions to the design change in weight and movement and how the adjustment is affecting other configurations within the warship because the service branch takes into account the total physical structure and how the altering of the design impacts other parts of the Ford-class ships. Former defense officials and experts told The Hill the designers moved the island more toward from the middle of the carriers to the back of the vessel to carve out more space for fighter jets to move around on the flight deck, which in turn increases the number of flights or sorties the carrier can generate. So just like at an airport, right, where everything gets jammed, you got a traffic jam, it slows down the flight rates, and so by having more space, they're able to move things around more quickly and generate flights more easily, Clark, an expert in naval operations, told The Hill on Monday. Moving the island would require finding a new way to support the weight of it, having to change the internal parts of the ship, and assessing the impact on the vessel's stability, since the command center tower carries a lot of weight that adjusts the center of gravity. When it tips over it, it rights itself, so instead of capsizing, it just pops back up to the vertical. And if you've got the island in the wrong spot, then you end up making it unstable. And then when the ship tips over, it ends up being you get these large oscillations that are obviously not useful for a ship to do, Clark said, adding that it is harder to generate flights if the ship is bouncing around too much. Apart from reducing the time it takes to launch jets and park more fighter planes near the E-mails, the position of the island improves landing by reducing turbulence on the deck, Sadler said. The USS Enterprise and USS Doris Miller are in various stages of construction. Over the weekend, Hill's HII's Newport News Shipbuilding completed acceptance sea trials for the USS John F. Kennedy, another Ford-class carrier. The USS Gerald R. Ford, the world's largest aircraft carrier that took 17 years to build, recently completed an 11-month deployment in May. Sadler of the Heritage Foundation argued the Navy should have compiled all of the Ford's performance data on the ship's arresting gear, elevators, emails, and other systems, and sent it over to Congress even before Trump returned for his second term. How many hundreds of hours did you have downtime? What are the high failure rate parts? Are they hard to get? Are they expensive? That kind of level of detail, high failure rate parts or incidence rates, as well as downtime, and they didn't. They've never given that kind of information. The Navy touted the emails and AAG systems on the Ford earlier this year, saying they were made to deliver greater lethality and joint interoperability. While the Navy is still analyzing the data, preliminary reports from the sortie generation rate test program show that the flight deck design in conjunction with the emails and AAG have contributed to an increased sortie generation rate compared to that of a Nimitz-class carrier, the service branch said on February 28. By all that data that I'm getting, and based on the press release back in February, it should be pretty good. And even people who are aware of it are telling me, yeah, the data is really good, Sadler said. Roughhead, who was the deputy commander of the U.S. Pacific Command, said emails are superior to the steam-powered catapult and hydraulic sortie systems, because they can be tuned to launch different weights of the airplanes, from heavy joint strike fighters to unmanned aircraft that will likely be much lighter in the future. I think we should move toward a hybrid air wing that has a variety of aircraft, is manned and unmanned. Various weights and emails gives you that flexibility to safely launch those and not overstress a smaller, lighter airplane, Roughhead said. He also noted that the workforce at these shipyards would have to adapt to making steam catapults, an adjustment considering the last carrier to have them was in the Nimitz class. Do you have the trades? Do you have the experience? Do you have that knowledge? And again, the learning curve of going back to that, Roughhead added. Clark of the Hudson Institute said the potential shifting of the command center tower toward the middle of the carrier strike would cost billions of dollars, and it would delay the delivery of ships already under construction, a bump in the road considering the Navy is already experiencing this shortage of carrier capacity. Russell Vaught, the director of the Office of Management and Budget, defended the president's Thursday national security memo, where he required Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and Acting Navy Secretary Hung Cao to deliver the White House a plan within 2 months to swap emails with steam and hydraulic systems for the construction of CVN-81. The Ford class is too costly, and it takes too long to build. Lead ships typically cost the most, but the Fords are costlier, with each one $13 billion for the initial Ford, then $15 billion for the Kennedy and Enterprise, and $16 billion expected for the Miller, Vought wrote Friday morning on social media. And if we retire a Nimitz class every 4 years, or replace them every 12, at minimum, based on projections, you have far fewer carriers, he continued. Not acceptable. Representative Joe Courtney, Democrat of Connecticut, the ranking member of the House Armed Services Subcommittee on Sea Power and Projection Forces, said the memo has some good ideas, namely to build a new fifth naval shipyard to bolster submarine and aircraft carrier repair capacity, and a component repair center to speed up maintenance. But Courtney panned the return to steam catapults as a ludicrous idea that really discredits the whole policy and defeats the whole purpose of avoiding delays and cost overruns. His demand to shift the island for aesthetic purposes is another massive design change that adds risk for personnel and further violates the goals of his own EO, the Connecticut Democrat said in a statement to The Hill on Monday. The story: Mamdani hits challenges even as his popularity rises in polls. New York City Mayor Zohran Mamdani, Democrat, is facing some steep challenges to more than 7 months into his historic tenure, but New York has shown no sign of souring on him. A CNA College poll out last week found that 69% of New York City voters had a favorable view of Mamdani, a notable jump from 58% in June. The latest figure narrowly topped his previous high from January, when 68% of New Yorkers held a favorable view of their new mayor. His numbers dipped to 56% in March before rebounding this month, even as Mamdani has consistently polled above his recent predecessors. Mamdani has brought the strong communication skills and political instincts he displayed on the campaign trail to City Hall, helping him retain public support as he navigates the challenges of governing. But the first 7 months of Mamdani's mayoralty have not been without hiccups. He now faces legal roadblocks to one of the most significant policy priorities, a pie-to-tear tax that has allowed the Democratic Socialist mayor to tout his push to tax the rich by targeting those who own second homes above a certain value. And he continues to navigate tensions over Israel and anti-Semitism as the first Muslim mayor of the city with the largest Jewish population outside of Israel, even as resentment toward Israel continues to grow among parts of his political base. He still excels at retail politics, which has been a great strength that can assuage voters' concerns about areas where he's still trying to find his footing, but his relationship with Jewish voters still needs repair before it becomes a hallmark of his mayoralty. Political analyst Basil Smickle, a former executive director for the New York Democratic Party, told The Hill, last week three New Yorkers sued the city over the rollout, taking aim at its distribution of a list with the information of thousands of residents who could be subject to the new tax and letters informing them they might have to pay for it. A Staten Island judge on August 10 halted the rollout, but the city successfully appealed the temporary restraining order Thursday, allowing the city to proceed with the tax plan as the legal process continues. Mamdani responded to the lawsuit by saying he and his administration will vigorously defend our city's position in court, and adding they are confident in our position. That is a confidence coming from both the legality of the city's actions as well as the importance of a surcharge on secondary homes worth more than $5 million, a surcharge that will help fund safer streets, that will help fund stronger schools, and it will help fund the city that New Yorkers deserve, Mamdani continued. Revenue from the tax will go toward closing the more than $8 billion budget gap expected in the coming years, according to Mamdani's office. Critics have noted that the estimated $340 million to $380 million it would generate amounts to only a fraction of what's needed to close the gap. He ran for office, promising to raise income taxes. That was a big part of his platform. He failed at that miserably, said Tusk Ventures CEO Bradley Tusk, who ran Michael Bloomberg's successful New York City mayoral campaign, in an interview with The Hill. They threw him a bone with a pied-à-terre tax, he continued, referring to the state government. It's a very meager thing. It's just not a big deal one way or the other. Tusk, who also previously worked for Senator Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, said he expects the pied-à-terre tax to take effect, noting the lawsuit does not challenge the legality of the tax itself. But he criticized the city for publishing the list of residents who could be subject to the tax, calling it a political tactic that played to a very specific group of people at the expense of everyone else. In a world where political violence in all kinds of ways is on the rise, to effectively dox a million of your own constituents is one of the most irresponsible things I've ever seen a politician in New York do, Tusk said, this side of Donald Trump at least. Mamdani is also facing growing calls from Jewish leaders in New York City to tone down his anti-Israel rhetoric amid concerns about safety and rising anti-Semitism. On Friday, two people were attacked at Central Synagogue, the largest Reform congregation in New York City, as hundreds of Jews gathered for Shabbat services. Police charged 46-year-old Larry Montez with felony hate crimes. After a Jewish man was stabbed last month in an attack, police also charged as a hate crime, Jewish leaders in the city pointed the finger at Mamdani, accusing him of fanning the flames of hatred and division by singling out Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu as a war criminal in a formal address. When the mayor of New York repeatedly uses his platform to relentlessly single out and demonize Israel, the world's only Jewish state, and calls those who support it monsters, he contributes to a climate in which Jewish New Yorkers are increasingly targeted and unsafe, said Eric Goldstein, the CEO of the UJA Federation of New York, shortly after the attack. The mayor held an hour-long meeting last week with 10 rabbis, spanning the political and religious spectrums, who sought to convey concerns about the effect his rhetoric toward Israel has on the safety of Jewish New Yorkers, according to reports of the private meeting. Mamdani on Thursday described the meeting as candid and productive and touted some of his office efforts to combat anti-Semitism. My door will always be open to every Jewish New Yorker, and that is a door that is open not only to a conversation, but also to a commitment of what it actually looks like to deliver on the ideal of a city where not only is everyone safe, but everyone belongs, everyone is made to feel as if this is their home, he said at a press conference. At 34 years old, Mamdani is the youngest mayor to lead New York City in more than a century, and his knack for political communication has helped him project an image of an active and responsive city hall. The mayor's office regularly posts videos on social media touting progress on Mamdani's policy agenda and showcasing him engaging with the community, including some smaller-scale undertakings like filling potholes. In just 8 months, Mayor Mamdani has filled over 180,000 potholes, launched the city's first-ever 2K program, financed over 12,000 affordable homes, achieved record-low murders and shooting victims, won $104 million in additional tips for delivery workers, and this is just the beginning, said Joe Cavello, Mamdani's press secretary, in a statement to The Hill. Decision Desk HQ chief elections analyst Jeffrey Skelly said Mamdani's strong standing could come down to being a very, very good at promoting the things that he's doing and looking like he's actually doing things as mayor. At a time when people are very skeptical about institutions and about politicians, Mamdani has essentially tried to promote the idea that, yeah, the mayor's office can do things, we're doing things, the city can do things, Skelly said. Part of that is a better mastery of self-promotion, Skelly continued, but it's also understanding that that's what people really would like to see, and so the fact that you're giving them evidence that you're trying to do things probably makes them more appreciative. The story Trump put to the test with Mills in Florida primary fight. President Trump's endorsement is being put to the test again this week as Representative Corey Mills, Republican of Florida, vies for a third term while multiple controversies threaten to derail the congressman's re-election bid. Mills has been under investigation since November, with the House Ethics Committee looking into allegations that the congressman violated campaign finance laws and engaged in sexual misconduct, among other accusations. The panel is also investigating an incident in which a woman reported to police that Mills had assaulted her before later recanting her statement Mills has denied any wrongdoing in those cases. The president notably backed Mills in February, calling him an America First patriot and tremendous champion for the great people of Florida's 7th Congressional District, while several prominent Florida Republicans have backed one of his three challengers or stayed out of the race. Trump has not rescinded his endorsement, but in a likely nod to the primary's changing tides, the president's recent advertisement of Florida primary endorsements excluded the congressman. The Hill has reached out to the White House for comment. Mills is clearly going to be helped to some extent by Trump's endorsement, but it does seem like Trump's endorsement is not a guarantee of overcoming your own myriad issues. Decision Desk HQ Chief Elections Analyst Jeffrey Skelly told The Hill, most of Trump's initial endorsees have sailed through their primaries, but the president took a hit in gubernatorial primaries in Iowa, Georgia, and South Carolina, while two of his GOP picks for congressional seats, Representative Andy Ogles in Tennessee and Amir Hassan in Michigan, lost primaries earlier this month. But the president could risk a repeat of those losses Tuesday when Mills faces off against Republican challengers, including Army veteran Michael Johnson, former local news anchor Ryan Elijah, and real estate businesswoman Sarah Ulrich for the new Smyrna Beach-based House seat. Last fall, the House panel announced it was looking into several allegations regarding Mills, in addition to questions around potential sexual misconduct and campaign finance violations in his last two House bids. The committee is also investigating whether he properly filled out disclosure statements to the House, received special treatment because of his position, misused congressional resources or status, and improperly sought after or obtained gifts. In May, the panel added that its probe also included circumstances around a court injunction that significantly curbed Mills from engaging with a former girlfriend online or in person, in addition to an event last year in which police responded to a woman's call that she had been assaulted by Mills before she later recanted. Mills has denied the allegations and refused to leave his seat. His office did not respond to the Hill's request for comment. Absolute zero criminal and or civic-ish cases that are open against me, Mills told CBS News in April. I've never been arrested, charged, or prosecuted for a single thing. However, that hasn't stopped some of Mills' House colleagues from supporting one of his primary challengers, Florida GOP Representatives Anna Paulina Luna and Mike Haridopoulos, have both backed Elijah on the Tuesday primary. Florida House Republicans, including Brian Mast, Gus Belirakis, and John Rutherford, have endorsed Mills. Governor Ron DeSantis, Republican, has declined to back the incumbent in his primary, telling reporters last week, "I have not endorsed Corey Mills, and I do not support Corey Mills." Trump won the district by double digits in 2024, and the nonpartisan election handicapper Cook Political Report rates Mills' seat as likely Republican, but Skelly notes that Democrats are feeling hopeful about changing the tides on the embattled congressman's district. Former NASA Chief of Staff Bale Dalton is the frontrunner for the Democratic nod Tuesday. I certainly think Democrats would like Mills to win if the pure goal is to try to have their best shot at winning this seat in November, he told The Hill. The story, drug makers uninterested in Trump's order to split up MMR vaccine. President Trump's executive order recommending that the measles, mumps, and rubella, or MMR vaccine, be split up across three appointments is drawing poor reception from the pharmaceutical industry, as drug makers and trade groups say there's no scientific reasoning to follow the directive. The administration did not provide any new scientific data to support splitting up the shot, and drug companies were quick to decry the order in light of the climbing measles rate in the U.S., the highest in more than 30 years. Splitting up the MMR vaccine into separate doses would likely entail 6 visits to complete a full schedule, as opposed to the 2 doses the combined vaccine is currently administered in. At a time when measles outbreaks are already threatening communities across the country, making vaccination more complicated and burdensome, risks further reducing vaccination rates, and leaving more children vulnerable to a highly contagious and potentially deadly disease, said Dr. Ronald G. Nahas, president of the Infectious Diseases Society of America, in a statement. Trump argued last week that nothing bad can happen from breaking up the shots, but critics argued that splitting up the vaccines would incur higher costs for families, which would have to pay several more copays for the added clinic visits, and they noted compliance would likely go down as patients would become more likely to miss appointments. The combined MMR vaccine was first developed in 1971. There are 2 major manufacturers of the MMR vaccine in the U.S., Merck and GSK. Bringing 3 monovalent vaccines would involve a slew of regulatory hurdles and potentially cost billions. Currently, no single antigen measles, mumps, or rubella vaccines are approved in the U.S., a source familiar with vaccine manufacturing told The Hill. This means it would take years to bring those to market if they were separated. While monovalent vaccines existed previously, these companies would need to develop essentially entirely new products to go through the Food and Drug Administration's drug approval process, which can take years. After approval, launching new manufacturing lines alone can take between 5 and 10 years and billions of dollars, as the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America previously stated in a policy briefing. From a financial standpoint, drug makers have little reason to follow through with splitting up the MMR vaccine. Vaccines are already not major cash cows for drug makers, an issue the International Monetary Fund, or IMF, highlighted during the pandemic. The IMF noted a major factor hampering the development of new vaccines is the considerable risk of unprofitability, even for successful vaccines. In the U.S., the Federal Vaccines for Children program purchases roughly half of all childhood vaccines at a discounted rate. White House officials were asked about what incentive companies would have to split up the MMR vaccine after Trump signed his executive order. Their response indicated they haven't come up with any yet. That, again, is a specific director of the HHS task force who will be working through that with the companies, one White House official said, referring to the Department of Health and Human Services. I think right now we have a lot of Americans and a lot of American parents who want to see additional options. So in a market-based solution, their desire for those options will help inform the manufacturer, vaccine manufacturer's decisions. The executive order gives federal officials 90 days to present a plan on splitting up the vaccines. Merck and GSK didn't make monovalent vaccines for individually preventing measles, mumps, or rubella, and neither seems convinced to take up the task. To date, there has been no published scientific evidence that shows any benefit to in separating the combination MMR vaccine into 3 individual shots. Use of the individual components of combination vaccines increases the number of injections for the individual and may result in delayed or missed immunizations, Merck said following Trump's signing of the order. Evidence suggests that the use of combination vaccine improves childhood vaccination outcomes, increasing both completion, receipt of all recommended doses, and compliance, age-appropriate administration rates, the company added. GSK said in its statement, "We stand by the safety and effectiveness of our combination vaccines, which are backed by decades of global use and robust scientific evidence. The overarching tune coming from the pharmaceutical industry seems to be that companies need a sound scientific rationale to even consider splitting up the MMR vaccine. Decisions about vaccines must be rooted in science, the source familiar with vaccine manufacturing said. We know that the MMR vaccine is safe and effective because it has been used for decades to help prevent infection from measles, mumps, and rubella for hundreds of millions of people. In fact, measles was declared eliminated in the United States in 2000 thanks to widespread vaccination with the MMR vaccine. The story, Moskowitz, Wasserman, Schultz, dual progressives in redistricted South Florida. Democratic Representatives Jared Moskowitz of Florida and Debbie Wasserman Schultz of Florida are both set to duel progressive rivals in Tuesday's primary as they fight for re-election in newly redistricted South Florida. Moskowitz, running in Florida's new 25th congressional district, faces a challenge from his left in Oliver Larkin, who's backed by the Democratic Socialists of America, or DSA, and aiming to bring this cycle's string of progressive wins to the toss-up South Florida seat. Wasserman Schultz, who currently represents Florida's 25th district, is running in the solidly blue and newly reshaped 20th district. She faces a crowded field of candidates, including progressive Elijah Manley. Both races spotlight incumbents' efforts to stay in the House after GOP-friendly redistricting dramatically reshaped the Sunshine State, as well as the anti-establishment mood sweeping Democratic primaries this cycle. At President Trump's urging, Florida jumped into the national mid-decade redistricting war earlier this year, aiming to boost the GOP from a 20-8 majority in the congressional delegation to a 24-4 advantage. I do think there's a decent chance that Republicans are going to come up short on their net 4-seat strat target, Decision Desk HQ's or DDHQ chief elections analyst Jeffrey Skelly said. He pointed to Florida's 25th district, which DDHQ currently rates as the state's lone must-win House toss-up. Moskowitz and Kathy Castor in the Tampa area seat, those are both winnable for Democrats, Skelly said. Democratic Representative Kathy Castor of Florida is unopposed in her primary for Florida's 14th district, and DDHQ rates it lean Democratic. You can see the combination of the national environment and incumbents who are stronger than the Democratic baseline, and those things coming together, along with a little boost from incumbency to perhaps allow those Democrats to hold on despite everything, the chief elections analyst added. But first, Moskowitz has to clear the primary in the coastal Atlantic district, where the DSA is aiming for its last midterm primary win after a string of successes in blue urban House districts. DSA-backed Larkin is pitching a working-class focus and shrugging off concerns that a left-wing platform could be a general election liability in the battleground district, which skews older and has large concentrations of Hispanic and Jewish voters. But Moskowitz is leading in polls and fundraising, as his supporters argue his more moderate tack is Democrats' best chance of winning the battleground. The things that worked in Colorado or worked in New York, like it's just not this district, said Florida Democratic strategist Steve Shale, pointing to past DSA wins. DSA co-chair Ashiq Sadiq told The Hill that regardless of the results on Tuesday, Larkin's competitive campaign has shown that there is a real hunger, especially in a red state like Florida, for a working-class agenda. I think the challenge for Oliver Larkin is that this is a seat with an older population, and generally speaking, the success that we've seen either progressive or DSA-type candidates have been in places with larger numbers of younger voters, said Skelly, noting that the odds of Democrats flipping the House improve if Moskowitz clinches the nomination and wins in November. Across the aisle, well-funded Boca Raton Mayor Scott Singer has led the GOP primary in sparse polling ahead of Tuesday. Also in the running are former State Representative George Mariatis and Joe Kaufman, who was the 2024 nominee against Moskowitz in Florida's old 23rd district. Meanwhile, Democrats are poised to hold on to the redrawn 20th district in Broward County, and Tuesday's primary will effectively seal the seat's next representative. The plurality black district has pulled in multiple black candidates, including former Representative Sheila Sherfalus McCormick, who resigned from the 20th district in April amid allegations of financial misconduct. The former lawmaker has maintained she's done no wrong, suggesting political motives behind the congressional investigation that prompted her resignation, but her comeback bid is up against a crowded field. Manley, a 27-year-old progressive organizer, has stood out in fundraising. He was supported on the trail last week by squad member Representative Rashida Tlaib, Democrat of Michigan, and he's the only candidate other than Wasserman Schultz who's raised more than $1 million in the race. He certainly put together a lot of resources for it, but for what it's worth, I mean, we have seen progressive candidates who are black not necessarily do well in a lot of places. And again, we're still in South Florida, Skelly said of Manley. And with several other black candidates in the ring, the divided field may set the stage for Wasserman Schultz, a House veteran free of the scandal that's plagued Sherfalus McCormick, to emerge from Tuesday's primary, even though her bid has frustrated some local black leaders who think the district should be represented in Congress by a black lawmaker. Wasserman Schultz told the Associated Press in a report this week that she's not airdropping herself into the district, stressing that she's represented diverse communities before. You have four notable black candidates and one also very notable and well-established white candidate, and the district's population, while the primary electorate will probably be a majority black, is not overwhelmingly so. It's a very demographically diverse seat, Skelly said. I think you can see all the components here for Wasserman Schultz to win against a fragmented opposition that never coalesced behind one candidate, he continued. The story, California is awesome and awesomely mismanaged. There are too many reasons to list that explain why California has become a basket case of governance, but the most persuasive one of all may be that California is awesome, or in the parlance of the state, totally awesome. We know well the history of how so many resource-rich places end up with bad governments, whether it's oil-rich nations like Saudi Arabia or Russia, or American states with predominant extractive industries like West Virginia and Louisiana. When revenue comes right out of the ground, leaders don't have to win arguments to obtain funding. You can try to build a ski resort in the Arabian Desert, turn your college football team into a gilded glory, or even launch an ill-advised invasion of a neighboring country if you don't need to tax the ordinary people. Ordinary taxes mean trade-offs and limits to power. Abundant natural resources mean either just squeezing producers or, even easier, nationalizing them. California has abundant natural resources. Even with lots of environmental restrictions, the Golden State is still pumping out some 250 million barrels of oil a year, lots of high-value minerals like gold, rare earths and boron, and 200,000 tons of seafood annually. But California's chief natural resource is its climate. Good weather is what makes California America's largest agricultural state by a long shot. At more than $61 billion a year, it almost doubles the big agricultural states like Iowa and Nebraska, but good weather is also why agriculture represents only 3% of state gross domestic product, as opposed to Iowa, where the share is more like 20%. People love the California sunshine in the south, but they also love the misty moderation of the central coast. What a Mediterranean climate did for the glory of Greece and the grandeur of Rome, it has done for the stunning success of California industries, from aerospace to computer technology to entertainment. You can say there's a better business climate in Texas, but as for the actual climate, San Francisco's low and high temperature Monday were 58 degrees and 67 degrees. In Austin, it was 103 degrees with more than 40% humidity. Gross. California is also as beautiful as it is big, from the quasi-rainforests in the Klamath Mountains to the desert of Palm Springs, California, has it all. Same-day surf two slopes is a real thing, and all that agriculture means the food and wine are some of the best in the world. It's a wonderful place to live, work, visit, and play. If you could work anywhere, why not someplace totally awesome and not in a place like Austin, where it feels like living in a St. Bernard's mouth for 5 months of the year? That's been good enough for California to afford to make a lot of mistakes and mostly sustain a broken system. Since the beginning of this century, state general expenditures increased by more than 200% to $248 billion, while the state's population grew by about 15%. That means per resident spending went from $2,300 to about $6,300 as the number of state employees increased by about 50%. As Fareed Zakaria asked in a recent column, does anyone think that California's government and its benefits have gotten 200% better in the last 25 years? Impossibly high housing prices, heavy taxes, chronic homelessness, failing schools, and a stagnant job market in 2021 contributed to California's first ever population decline and continues to fuel out-migration. If the question was how much cushion does California's beauty and beautiful climate afford for bad governance, the answer came in the form of the COVID-19 pandemic. California had been the Saudi Arabia of good weather and had built a wasteful, inefficient, bloated government to match, but resource-rich places can and do fail. Oil giant Venezuela was once one of the wealthiest countries in the world, and now it's a poverty-stricken American client state. An unfortunate coincidence in California's development was that the state went through its first major period of sustained growth during the Progressive Era. Teddy Roosevelt Republicanism was the dominant flavor of the early 20th century California politics. Then, as now, one of the core tenets of progressivism was that direct democracy was superior to representative democracy. As a result, the mismanagement that has distorted California is not that of an oligarchical state elite, but of the voters themselves in the land of the plebiscite. Do California voters want low taxes or more spending? Yes. Do California voters want restrictions on illegal immigration or more services for illegal immigrants? Yes. With among the most permissive rules for ballot referenda, California has watched its policies lurch in contradictory directions as the populist wave crashes from left to right and back again. Voters don't have to take responsibility for imprudent policy preferences the way elected officials have to do. You can recall the governor, but you can't recall the electorate. And this year, California has a doozy of an offering for voters, Proposition 40, branded as the billionaire tax. The new rule would assess a one-time 5% wealth tax on individuals and trusts with assets, stocks and business holdings, art and intellectual property worth more than $1 billion as of January 1, 2026. The ballot measure was made retroactive so that rich folks couldn't dodge the tax by fleeing the state after the vote, though many did so before the start of this year, just as the threat that it might pass. California, its tech sector particularly, has grown a bumper crop of billionaires like artichokes in the San Joaquin Valley. There are about 1,000 billionaires in the United States, and about 1 in 5 of them lives in California. That's a lot of potential cash for Sacramento, except that not all billionaires are created equal. While some are just watching compound interest do its work, many are highly leveraged and short on cash. As the recent debate between Texas billionaire Mark Cuban and Representative Ro Khanna, Democrat of California, has highlighted, if the tax is approved, it could necessitate the sale or breakup of many companies as founders and owners have to scramble for cash. That's maybe not a bad thing if you don't think there should be billionaires in the first place, but if you work for one of those companies or live in a country served by the taxes those companies pay, maybe it's a little more complicated. The debate is only now starting to in earnest, but the polling suggests a substantial but not prohibitive edge for the tax, 48% to 41%. One imagines, though, that as a Democratic enthusiasm continues to run hot and Republicans feel increasingly dispirited about the midterms, November's electorate may be even more lopsidedly left than usual. As Democrats coast-to-coast have their intense argument between democratic socialism and old-fashioned liberalism, the mainstream can't point to more wins than losses. For every Zohran Mamdani, there are probably five Roy Coopers. But on Election Day, if California enacts a first-of-its-kind billionaire tax, it's going to be among the strongest signs yet that the party is heading for a hard-left turn in 2028. Chris Steierwalt is the politics editor of The Hill and the host of The Hill Sunday. The story: Democratic lawmakers demand answers from Hegseth on USS Abraham Lincoln. A group of 15 senators said Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth owes Americans answers about the ongoing deployment of the USS Abraham Lincoln aircraft carrier strike group after reports of low morale and a mental health crisis among service members aboard. In an August 15 letter to Hegseth, signed by all 13 members of the Senate Armed Services Committee, minority as well as the Democratic leaders of the Senate Appropriations Committee and Defense Subcommittee, lawmakers demanded information about mounting evidence that the conditions aboard the carrier have deteriorated to the point that the safety and well-being of its crew could be compromised. The USS Lincoln, which departed San Diego in November, has now been deployed for more than 260 days, including more than 200 consecutive days without a port call, setting a modern-day record for continuous time at sea for a U.S. aircraft carrier. The ship was originally intended to return home in May, but was redirected to the Middle East in January, ahead of the Iran war. Family members of the sailors and Marines serving aboard have told several outlets that they've received urgent messages about food and water shortages, broken plumbing, exhaustion and mental health issues, serious enough that multiple sailors have attempted to jump overboard. These are deeply troubling reports, and the American people deserve honest answers, they wrote. Hegseth last week said that conditions aboard the Lincoln have been completely misrepresented, and Acting Navy Secretary Hung Cao announced Friday that the ship was returning home, accusing the media of trying to paint our warriors as victims, even as he allowed that a small number of mental health cases were treated. Cao also insisted the ship's deployment was extended because the mission demanded it. The U.S. military is now sending the USS George Washington to the Middle East in place of the USS Lincoln. But the lawmakers say the issues with the USS Lincoln are a symptom of poor planning by Hegseth and President Trump, exacerbated by the deeply unsound decision to start a war with Iran. The added open-ended deployments driven by an open-ended war have real consequences for our service members, and we are seeing those consequences now. The lawmakers are pressing Hegseth for the timeline for the USS Lincoln's relief and return to home port, the specific operational requirements that drove the continued extensions of the deployment, whether crew was informed of the extensions, and whether any crew have been changed out since November. They also want to know what mental health, medical, and chaplain resources are being provided to the crew, whether there have been any suicides or suicide attempts aboard the ship during the deployment, and whether the Pentagon will allow a bipartisan congressional delegation to visit the USS Lincoln. Denial and defensiveness are not acceptable responses. Congress and these families need accountability, they said in the letter. A group of House Democrats also pressed Cao for information on the conditions aboard the USS Lincoln in a Friday letter. Future of Florida GOP up for grabs with Donald's in pole position. Republican eyes are shifting to Florida today as voters head to the polls to choose a successor to term-limited Governor Ron DeSantis, Republican. The Sunshine State has undergone a significant political transformation over the past 8 years since DeSantis was first elected, shifting from one of the top battleground states in the country to a solid Republican stronghold. Representative Byron Donalds, Republican of Florida, who is endorsed by President Trump, is hoping to continue the GOP's dominance in the state with a win in the primary Tuesday, but a few opponents, including a highly controversial far-right challenger, are seeking to pull off an upset. If he wins the nomination, as he's favored to do, he'll certainly be the favorite in the general election. Donalds would be Florida's first black governor. The three-term congressman has the support of the most influential figure in the Republican Party in Trump, along with many other notable GOP officials, including Florida's two senators, Rick Scott and Ashley Moody. But Donalds is facing opposition from several high-profile rivals, including Florida Lieutenant Governor Jay Collins and investment firm founder James Fishback. Former State House Speaker Paul Renner is also seeking the nomination. Despite being significantly outraised and outspent by Donalds, Fishback is hoping he can pull off a stunning upset after a tense campaign that has been frequently defined by inflammatory comments and personal attacks. Fishback, who is white with Colombian heritage, has made several race-related remarks throughout his campaign, including some pointed at Donalds. He has repeatedly referred to Donalds as a slave to corporate interests and donors, referring to him as Byron in a special social media post, and alleged Donalds' election would turn Florida into a Section 8 ghetto. Fishback has also positioned himself as a harsh critic of U.S. support for Israel and faced accusations of anti-Semitism. He's used the term goyslop to refer to fast food, invoking an online term that's caught on among anti-Semitic sectors of the Internet. Fishback has denied he's anti-Semitic and vowed to represent all Floridians regardless of background if elected, but his comments spurred an organization allied with Texas Senator Ted Cruz, Republican, to spend $400,000 on an ad campaign targeting Fishback for alleged anti-Semitism. Polling has been split on how large Donald's lead is. Some surveys have shown Donald's ahead by double digits, approaching or surpassing 50%, but a few others have shown a much closer race. In the latest public poll of the race, Donald's led by less than 5 points, with 34% support to Fishback's 29.4%. The Decision Desk HQ polling average shows Donald's more comfortably ahead with 37% support, followed by Fishback with 18.4% and Collins with 16.6%. Adding to the uncertainty is DeSantis, who has declined to endorse any candidate to succeed him. He remains highly popular among Florida Republicans, and there's some signs that he may be using his influence against Donalds. The relationship between DeSantis and Donalds has reportedly worsened in the past couple of years, stemming in part from Donalds' decision to endorse Trump in the 2024 Republican presidential primary over his own state's governor. CNN reported DeSantis has worked for months publicly and privately to argue Donalds isn't fit to replace him, even sharing his concerns with Trump, a person close to DeSantis told the outlet. But DeSantis has largely stayed out of the race publicly otherwise and has not thrown his support behind any of Donald's opponents. He did praise Renner in comments earlier this month, but stopped short of an endorsement. While Donald's appears on track to win the nomination, a strong showing from Fishback would quickly put Florida on the map for Democrats this November. Former Representative David Jolly, who served as a Republican but has since joined the Democratic Party, is viewed as the favorite to win the party's nomination for governor. Also on tap, Florida is also holding primaries for its seats in the House after lawmakers revised the state's congressional map this spring to increase the number of Republican-held seats. That resulted in a scramble among the state's congressional Democrats as some chose to jump districts to keep their chances of staying in Congress alive, while others are choosing to battle it out in their home district against tougher odds. Two of those Democrats are Representatives Jared Moskowitz, who is trying to fend off a Democratic Socialist challenger in a battleground district, and Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who is running in a plurality black district, frustrating some parts of the Democratic base, The Hill's Julia Miller reports. And Trump's endorsement power will be tested again as controversial Representative Corey Mills tries to hold on to win the GOP nomination for another term, despite a House Ethics Committee investigation into him, the Hill's Caroline Baikle reports. Three things to know. The U.S. Navy has awarded a $22.9 billion contract to Raytheon to accelerate the production of Tomahawk missiles amid a munitions shortage as a result of the Iran war. Raytheon said the seven-year contract will allow the annual Tomahawk production to increase to more than 1,000 missiles, up from its current level of 60 per year. A federal appeals court panel upheld an order disqualifying Saigal Chatta from serving as the top prosecutorial job in Nevada, ruling the administration's efforts to sidestep Senate confirmation where the Justice Department plans to appeal the decision to the Supreme Court, a spokesperson said. Luigi Mangione's state trial in the killing of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson has been postponed indefinitely after Mangione pleaded guilty to federal stalking charges on Friday. Mangione's lawyers are seeking to have the state murder case thrown out on grounds of double jeopardy. Halted border wall, Customs and Border Protection, or CBP Commissioner Rodney Scott, announced he would halt construction of the border barrier in Texas's Big Bend National Park following pushback from locals and bipartisan lawmakers. Last night I put a pause on all activity in that park as far as construction goes until I can get down there and do a personal evaluation, Scott said. CBP recently said it would no longer construct the planned 30-foot border wall and instead begin construction on limited vehicle barriers. But the concession did not quell the concerns of constituents who feared the physical wall would disrupt the park's beauty and wildlife, threaten indigenous sites, and significantly harm the local economy, as tourism is a major economic driver for the region, according to Senator John Cornman's, Republican of Texas, letter last week to the Department of Homeland Security. And finally, UK Prime Minister Andy Burnham exchanged text messages with someone he briefly believed to be White House Chief of Staff Susie Wiles, but was actually an impersonator. Politico first reported on the exchange, which ended after Burnham became suspicious. A source familiar with the situation told The Hill that the messages were of no significance. When the messages were sent and what was discussed is unclear. A White House official said the incident was unrelated to Wiles' personal cell phone having been hacked last year. Burnham succeeded Keir Starmer as Prime Minister last month after taking leadership of the Labour Party. Board of Peace talks, Special Envoy Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and representatives of Trump's Board of Peace for several hours on Monday to try to make progress toward a deal for the future of Gaza. Netanyahu appeared no closer to agreeing to the U.S. proposed plan, which he rejected last week, insisting Hamas disarmament come before any reconstruction. U.S. officials also gave no signal publicly that Israel made any commitments to withdraw from the 60% of Gaza in which Israeli troops currently occupy, which is a major sticking point for Hamas. Netanyahu, in a statement, called the talks deep and constructive and said Israel and the Board of Peace agreed to establish two working groups, one focused on disarmament and demilitarization, and the second one focused on public health issues in Gaza. Netanyahu reiterated, however, that Israel and the board agreed that demilitarization should be prompt and completed before any reconstruction.